from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We have a powerful hour lined up. We're going to be going to the United Kingdom and talking with Christina England, extremely important investigative journalist who has researched and written on the vaccine flaws, the pharmaceutical and vaccine industry corruption, and the science supporting the lack of efficacy and safety of vaccines. And she, in fact, earned Caregiver of the Year award in the United Kingdom. She's adopted two disabled boys, and it was later discovered that one of the boys who was diagnosed with his autism had severe reaction to the MMR vaccine. We're going to be talking with her about the World Health Organization's private vaccine laboratory. How intentional is the lack of safety in vaccine ingredients? Selecting the poor from Africa and other countries to experiment on, and always with impunity. We will show you the truth of that. We're going to also today look at the objectivity of the media when they accept money from people from, let's say, Bill Gates' foundation. The Seattle Times wrote an editorial on this. Does Gates' funding of media attain objectivity? And that I will open up for your feedback. From our environmental segment from Anna Meyer, this trade deal will make you sick. The Trans-Pacific Partnership could spell bad news for global food systems. Polluting politics, how the Koch brothers and other industries spend millions to gut our Clean Water Act protections. How the Clinton Foundation raked in hundreds of millions of dollars in cash from right-wing regimes and corporations. And then how they then support those. From Health and Nutrition, we have a lot of good information today about not microwaving your food from Edward Group of Health Freedom Alliance, why eating fats really doesn't make you fat, how chemical corporations buried report on endocrine disruptors to trade health for profit, and how in one study, extra oxygen spurred on tumor-fighting cells from Northeastern University. Wow, that means that oxygen therapy, like hyperbaric, is very important. Let's begin. And I will later on try to open it up, if time permits, for your feedback. Ohio State University has an interesting report, and it's something that all of us have at different times looked at, and that is, what happens when you tell your kids too often that they're special? Well, according to this study, telling your kids they're special may foster narcissism. Children who are told they're special by their parents are more likely to become narcissistic and selfish, including extreme selfishness. And that is the basis of this particular study. This was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, our most prestigious scientific organization. It's a peer-reviewed U.S. journal. And they looked at hundreds and hundreds of children and followed them for a period of a year and a half. And when the children were described by the parents as more special than other children and deserving something extra in life, they were more likely to test higher on scores of narcissism than those that were not treated this way. And when parents would talk about, my child is a great example for other children to follow, they're overvaluing their children. Growing up, I never heard any of this, nor did any of my friends. And the children were between 7 and 11 years of age. Quote, children believe it when their parents tell them that they are more special than others, and that may not be good for them or for society. Well, now take a look at this. I recently was asked to give some insight into a problem that had not been able to be resolved for several years. A person who was now 26 years of age, young, and all I was told is this is one of the most brilliant and special people you could imagine. But they can't function any longer in society. They can go between depressed to suicidal, withdrawal, won't take a shower, won't care for themselves, nothing. But in a simple conversation, I just ask for very short, not definitive answers, such as, when you were growing up, did you consider yourself special? Yes. And were you encouraged to be highly motivated to get ahead? Yes. And did you obey that? Yes. Did you do good in school? Top of the class. All through school? Yes. And then into college, and I believe college, I'll bet. Yes. Were you ever reminded how special you were and how everyone was counting upon you to be the best of the best? Constantly. Was it also true in sports? Yes. Now, when you got to this Ivy League school, did you find out there were about 4,000 other students just like you? Yes. So you have all four-point students, all the special, best, beautiful, bright, little goddesses, gods, all not walking because your parents don't believe you walk on the ground, you float. You're ethereal. You were born by some immaculate conception, they believe. What'd you do when you found there were a whole lot more like you? You get depressed and anxious because you weren't told that there'd be anyone equal to you. And now you find people are not just equal, but they have something else. And then when you get out of that school, was it enjoyable? No. You go to work where? Where special people go? On Wall Street. How many other special people are there? About 150,000. So now you're not just one special person in your community, your home, your family, but you're one of 150,000 just in this particular environment, and you're at the bottom end of all that. How's that make you feel? Terrible. Worthless. Suicidal. And what do people talk about? What are their values? What does a person talk about down on Wall Street? The only thing anyone ever talks about, ever, on Wall Street is themselves and what they're going to get and how they're going to be even more special. Give me an example. Were you ever invited to share in the houses in the Hamptons? Yeah. And explain that pecking order. Well, the pecking order is if you go to a house and there are 16 chairs, then you have 16 people who are not considered of any value. The people are considered value, the people make enough money that they don't have to share a house, they can rent a house. And then in that whole group of people that can rent a house, let's say there are 5,000 can rent a house, you're of no value unless you can rent a house that costs more than $100,000 a season. But then of those people who can rent a house for more than $100,000 a season, you're of no value unless your house is in a particular area. Irrespective, if you look at it from the air, you wonder, why does this house cost so much money? But it's all based upon perception. Everything is perception. It's all an illusion. So you keep having to, once you open a door, realize there's another door, and it's a bigger door that you have to open. Until one day, you hope to be able to own the house, not just rent it, year-round. And that would be a second home to your triplex, your duplex. You start with a single little studio and you work up. So do you actually have a life? Does anyone on Wall Street actually have a life? Is anyone actually there? The answer is unequivocally, absolutely no one. So all they're doing is rushing as if the gun went off and they're in this mad dash so they can prove their value epigenetically to all those messages. You're special. That's one of the most deadly things you can do to a human being. If they're special, let them show it by their deeds and actions in support of helping others. The kindness that they give, the interest they have, the curiosity that manifests in their discovery. But let them also have a life. Because when I ask this person, what did you remember about growing up that you enjoyed? Nothing. because we don't allow special people to ever have unguarded, unsupervised, non-micromanaged lives. They never had that ability as we did growing up. So the backstory, this Ohio University study, when they say, quote, telling kids they're special may foster narcissism, look at the President of the United States. Look at the people he surrounds himself with. Look at the people they surround themselves with. Look at the people who then want to be a part of that connection. Look at the people who compromise their values, honesty, morality, ethics, decency, in order to be accepted. Do you not think they all thought they were special? Because who would jump into the world's largest functioning septic system, overflowing with the human feces of Washington, D.C., except someone who thought they were special? Next, microwaving. Why shouldn't you have anything to do with microwave ovens? According to Edward Group, because microwaves are extremely dangerous. Microwaving, by the way, if you don't understand, it's a simple, convenient cooking option for people on the go. The microwave oven has been a mainstay in the U.S. for 30 years, virtually transforming society and how we view food. But we don't ask ourselves, what is the downside? So the downside is you're getting everything that goes into that oven and everything that is within about 8 feet of that oven getting non-ionizing radiation. Now, as a matter of contrast, ionizing radiation changes the electromagnetic nature of atoms or ionizes them. This alters the way they interact with other atoms and molecules around them, like X-rays and gamma radiation and nuclear medicine, like CAT scans, barium swallows, mammograms. Those are all ionizing radiation. So your food is being zapped by high-frequency waves of heat, and some people argue that this radiation can be harmful to your health. One study by Dr. Hans Hertel explored how microwaves change the molecular structure of food and the effects of that food on the human body. Now, in his study, he found that individuals who consume microwave foods experience a decrease in the HDL cholesterol. They had a reduced red blood cell count and fewer white blood cells, and that's not good. Your white blood cells, it's your immune system, and you want the HDL. So when that's reduced, you're more likely to have problems with your arteries and your heart. So microwaves overheat the inside, and they alter the DNA of whatever you're eating. And when it comes specifically to microwaves, damage to the food itself isn't the only concern. Many microwavable foods are processed and packaged in a way that you get all these chemicals in the plastic. And chemicals found in many of these containers include benzene and toluene, polyethylene, and xylene dioxins. These are known carcinogens or hormone disruptors. So at high temperatures, and that's what a microwave is, at high temperature, these chemicals can be absorbed into the food, and therefore when you eat the microwave food, you're eating lots of chemicals. And perhaps one of the most dangerous contaminants in microwavable food is PBA. And according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, they found PBA is an estrogen-like plastic leaked from all packaging into the food tested. PBAs disrupt normal hormone activity. Low libido, cardiac disease, mental disorders, allergies, high blood pressure, waking, all linked to PBA exposure. So just imagine this next time you go to microwave and you're going to get bad food. One thing that's not bad is if we eat quality fats. And the trouble is, what are the quality fats? What are the harmful fats? And fat in and of itself doesn't lead to obesity. That's a myth. In fact, there was just an article in the British Medical Journal that shatters the myth that fat causes obesity and heart disease. Researchers found that while lowering saturated fat in the diet can lower total cholesterol, it actually lowered the good cholesterol. And so you want coconut oil. You want avocado oil. Those are excellent. And olive oil, excellent. Macadamia nut, that's a phenomenal oil. By the way, and the best oil to cook with is mustard seed oil because it can resist changes at high temperatures. So those are the good fats. The fats also that I try to get every day in my diet, and I hope you do as well, would be from seeds, pumpkin seeds, sesame seeds, chia seeds, hemp seeds, and sesame seeds, or sunflower seeds. Now, if you eat fish, the best fat in fish are sardines and herring. And so those are the oils that are good, and they don't make you fat, and they help protect your brain. By the way, talking about hormone disruptors in our environment, there was an interesting article in The Guardian, and it was based upon a publication of the European Journal. An investigation, and it talked about the scientific report linking endocrine disrupting chemicals. There's your pesticides, by the way. There's your pharmaceuticals. There's your plastic containers, cosmetics. That's where you get these. And how these endocrine disruptors, which are foreign to the body, interfere with the human endocrine system. When that happens, disrupting the human endocrine system can result in developmental, reproductive, neurological, and immunological complications. And some one more reason to not just have natural stainless steel or crockery that's, let's say, glass. There's different types that you can use. Iron, cast iron, but stay away from aluminum because aluminum is a major endocrine disruptor. And it is a toxin to your brain cells. And then also a good reason to detoxify to get these endocrine-related conditions under control. Also, there was a good study from Northeastern University. Quote, a provocative study in mice suggests something as simple as breathing in extra oxygen might give immune cells a boost in attacking cancer. Quote, the immune system can often spot and destroy abnormal cells before they grow into cancer. But when tumors manage to take root, they put up defenses to block new immune attacks. And with the extra oxygen, quote, you remove the brake pedal that cancer can put on tumor-fighting immune cells. This is according to the director of the New England Inflammation and Tissue Protection Institute at Northeastern University. And here's what happens. I'll just try to break it into lay language. Tumors can grow so rapidly that they outpace their blood supply, creating a low oxygen environment. So the lack of oxygen, in turn, spurs cancer cells to produce a molecule called adenosine, which essentially puts nearly all of the tumor-fighting T cells, natural killer cells, to sleep. And so lots of research is underway to develop drugs that could block the adenosine effect. But this team found that getting more oxygen to an oxygen-starved tumor can strip away the tumor's defenses. So that's important. So the extra oxygen changed the tumor's environment so that immune cells could get inside and do their jobs. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Science Translational Medicine. Tumors shrank more in the high oxygen group, especially when the researchers combined the oxygen with injections of extra tumor-fighting T cells, what are called immunotherapy. So what does this mean in just everyday language? It means that when you go out for that run or power walk or power biking where you're in one gear, resistance gear, for an hour, you're hyper-oxygenating your blood. That's the best thing in the world you could do if you have cancer, including leukemia. If you live, as many people right now listening to this program, in the Boulder, Colorado area, where almost everyone's an athlete, and they're at 5,000 feet elevation. If you're in Santa Fe, you're at 7,000 feet, you're even higher, and you're out there working, you have to work harder. Your lungs have to work harder, your heart has to work harder in order to get the oxygen in, because you have less oxygen. The higher up you go, the less oxygen you have. Therefore, to make the available oxygen, you have to really concentrate. And that's why a lot of athletes, when they begin training at lower altitudes and go to higher altitude, they're fatigued until they accommodate themselves. I remember once, it was the Los Angeles Marathon, and Franco Pantone, my training buddy, racing buddy, we went out there to do it. And there were a lot of great athletes. And we were in the race walking group that we went out first, and they had the truck with the camera on the ground in front of us. That was kind of an odd thing. I'd never seen that before. Making sure that we were legal, meaning one foot always on the ground. And we had guys on bikes. And so the fastest ones went out, and we were right at the back end of that fast group. But the fastest guys, the guys I'd never seen legs move as fast, were the from Mexico City. And it was a team, the Mexican team, and they were expected to win. And we were talking, because when you're doing a marathon, you get with people and you encourage each other. You work, you all work together until the very end, and whoever's got it, he lets it out the last kick. But during it, there's great camaraderie, and you know, you grab a water for yourself, you grab a water for your competitor. It's just, it's the way athletes work. And that's what makes it the track and field, especially the long distance events, so interesting, because you have a whole conversation. And they're talking about, yeah, they train at 20 miles a day, and they're at 5,000 feet elevation, and therefore they're short, but they have enormous lung capacity. And they also are getting hyperbaric oxygen therapy, we were told, and they're getting blood that's been hyper-oxygenated, ozonated blood injected into their body. And so you're hearing all this stuff, and you've never heard this before. Training it at high altitude, getting more oxygen in. Well, and it went that way until the 20th mile mark, when Franco and I made our kick, we had anticipated that there'd be people who had better training conditions, but if they did 20 miles a day, we were going to do 25. And if they did 10 minutes in the gym, we were doing 2 hours on a VersaClimber. So we won. And it was a wonderful experience. But all the way back in the plane, I kept thinking about that. And then I spoke with some scientists who are friends of mine, and I said, what do you know about oxygen and cancer? And one of them said, look at the work of Dr. Otto Warburg, who won the Nobel Prize. And he showed that oxygen is more resistant, cancer is less resistant with a higher oxygen medium, but cancer thrives in a low oxygen medium. Now, some people have misinterpreted that. Cancer can never grow in a high oxygen medium, not true. But it is more challenging. That's what this study showed. So then start creating protocols to help people with cancer that emphasize oxygenation of the blood. Because what do most people with cancer do? They don't do anything. It's much like we used to keep people in bed long periods of time when they'd had, let's say, a surgery, instead of getting them up quicker. Now we know for most surgeries, getting a person up quicker, getting them on that bone that was, broken, is better for them. You've got to, in effect, you got to stress the body under controlled conditions in order for it to heal. So we make the mistake, historic, of older people, take it easy, you're older now. Nonsense. That's why so many died so earlier, prematurely. You should become more vigorous the older you get, not less. You should do more, not less. You should think more. You should act more. You should never retire. I think retirement is a dangerous concept for most people. So start getting people doing aerobics who have cancer on stationary bikes if they can't get outside. When they get outside, get outside. And then start taking the nutrients. Now, what is one of the best juices in the world to take if you want to oxygenate your blood? Wheatgrass and lemon juice. You take that 4, 5, 6 times a day. You're alkalizing. That hits the cancer. Your trimethylglycine, dimethylglycine, the high vitamin E's in the mix to tocopherols, tocotrienols, coenzyme Q10, ubiquinone. And now you're oxygenating the blood, and that stimulates the immune system and makes it easier to fight the cancer. Finally, better midlife fitness may slow the brain aging. Boston University School of Medicine, quote, people with poor physical fitness in their 40s may have lower brain volumes by the time they hit 60, an indicator of accelerated brain aging. And many people don't start worrying about their brain health until later in life. But this study provides more evidence that certain behaviors and risk factors in midlife may have consequences for brain aging later on, end quote. And that was from Dr. Sparteo and a postdoctoral fellow at Boston University School of Medicine. So the takeaway message, exercise a lot more than what we're doing. I always suggest the best I have seen for most people that I've worked with is 5 days a week. 5 days a week and for about an hour a day, and then you can help prevent your brain from shrinking and aging. You help your heart, your blood pressure, your cholesterol, your digestion. All good. I'm Gary Knoll. That's our latest health nutrition report. And now we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going right into a segment, a short segment, from a woman who I filmed who told the truth. I filmed her out in San Francisco. She came forward to talk about her, I think it was 15 years, of being one of the top, and I believe in 1 year she was the number one drug salesperson in America. Now, when you're filming someone, you want to film them, get as much as you can, even if you only use a small amount at that time in that particular film. She talked for over an hour. She's articulate, and I asked her basic questions. Did at any time you feel that what you were doing was immoral? Unethical. Why do you think you were chosen? Because I was young and attractive. Who do you think they choose? Do you ever see a drug detail person going in any doctor's office that is not young and attractive? I mean, she's just like that. So why is this segment important for you to hear? Because once again, people believe that vaccines are safe and effective. They believe that 25% of all women in America between 25 and 45, should be taking anti-anxiety medications and tranquilizers. We believe that it's okay for senior citizens to take up to 15 different medications, and almost all of them contradicted and contraindicated. We believe in the placebo effect, and we believe in the nocebo effect. The nocebo is the exact opposite, where you're taking a sugar pill, but you believe that there's going to be a negative outcome to it. And studies show that when you take a sugar pill, and if the doctor says your hair is going to fall out, your hair falls out. What if the doctor didn't tell us the negatives? What if they told us the positive, but also what if at the same time the doctor was honest and gave us proof that the therapy they were about to give us had benefited people without harming them? We never ask that. We assume it. So where do you think the doctor gets their information? From medical school? No. From reading articles? Most don't have the time. From drug detail people? Yes. So how accurate is that information? It's all lies. How objective is it? You're kidding me. That's a redundant statement. The whole purpose of selling a doctor drugs is so they can sell you the drugs, get you the prescription. The pharmaceutical industry knows that much of what they're doing is wrong, but they don't care that you're over-medicated with dangerous drugs and that more than 300,000 people will die this year because of that. All they care about is the profit. Back in a moment so you can hear her insights.
there's no such thing as a safe drug. By the time a drug's approved and it hits the general population, we don't know even 50% of the side effects that are involved with that drug. We were being trained to misinform people. I spent 15 years in the pharmaceutical industry working for some of the major manufacturers. It wasn't like I woke up one morning and said, you know, I need to get out of pharmaceutical sales. It was actually an awakening process for me. It was a spiritual and consciousness process where as I started observing what was happening, what some of the drugs were doing, the misinformation, the disinformation, that I was being encouraged to minimize side effects when I talked to doctors, I started to recognize that these patients were literally being tortured by the drugs that they were given. My niece was 20 years old. She was attending Indiana University, and she was a pre-med student. Extremely intelligent, beautiful woman, and just a beautiful spirit inside and out. She was in a car accident and was prescribed Vicodin, hydrocodone, for pain and became addicted. While she was studying, she determined that the sedative properties of her drugs were keeping her from being able to concentrate, so she purchased some ephedra, which is a stimulant. She had a drug interaction and ended up in the emergency room at the local hospital. And they tagged her with a bipolar illness diagnosis, not a drug toxicity or, reaction to the drugs that she was on. And they started giving her more major antipsychotics and mood stabilizers, and that set her on the road to becoming a mental patient. She eventually had to drop out of school after a 5-month period of trying to withdraw from Effexor and all of the other antipsychotics and drugs that they had put her on. She was extremely severely depressed, and her mom was on her way home to take her forcibly back to the psychiatrist and get her placed back on drugs. So my niece walked into her younger sister's room and took an angel-shaped lantern that was filled with oil and poured it over herself and ignited it, and she burned herself alive. It was a promise that I made to her that I would not let her memory be sullied, that I would tell people what in fact had happened to her, and that she would not be remembered as a mentally or genetically defective person, that I would not allow that to happen. And I realized that there are thousands and thousands of those people out there, and they need a voice, and I'm serving as that voice.
Now, how's this for a very scary number? In the last 10 years, the use of antipsychotic drugs on young children and teenagers has increased more than 500%. There's growing concern these drugs are being given in even greater doses to kids in foster care, putting them in a virtual chemical straitjacket. Here's national correspondent Byron Pitts with tonight's Eye on Your Children.
Yes, this child is on 6 different psychotropic drugs, 7 different psychotropic drugs.
Gwen Olson is a child advocate and a former pharmaceutical rep who quit her job and wrote this book, Confessions of an RX Drug Pusher, after seeing so many children given so many drugs.
They clamp down on the central nervous system. In effect, they reduce your mobility and that sort of thing. So they're sort of like a chemical straitjacket.
A large number of psychiatrists are dishonest because I see them giving people drugs that they know are brain-damaging therapeutics, that they know do not have positive long-term outcomes, that they know will not cure anything. They just take a list of symptoms and then they call it a mental illness or a mental disorder. And these are voted upon by psychiatrists. We can define people as being mentally ill, and therefore we can sell more drugs for the pharmaceutical industry. It's an extremely lucrative alliance because there's no scientific data that's required for a psychiatrist to diagnose a mental illness. There's no blood test, there's no urine test, there's no PET scan, there's no medical evidence required. And so therefore, that broadens the potential patient population considerably. I was so disillusioned, as well as angry, when I really found out how much deception, how much misinformation was taking place, and how I had been used in that game, because I literally was the one who was on the front lines. I was harming people unintentionally, but I was responsible, and I carry a burden for that now. I decided that in order for me to be able to live with myself based on what I had observed and participated in, that that I had a moral obligation to get out and inform other people. When I have talked to as many people that I have talked to in the last year, when I have seen as many psychiatric patients damaged, I know that what I'm doing is a calling. It's a spiritual calling for me. And I do it with great conviction and I do it with passion because I understand that this is a situation that's not going to get any better unless people that have this experience and knowledge start speaking out.
That's Gwen Olson. Now let's go over and say hello to my guest who is standing by. She is Christina England. And as I gave her background a little earlier, she is also the co-author with Dr. Harold Buttram of Shaken Baby Syndrome or Vaccine-Induced Encephalopathy. Nice to have you with us today, Christina.
Hello, it's lovely to be with you, and thank you for inviting me.
I feel we really need to begin asking some very dark and serious questions about the long-term intentions and designs of medicine, in particular certain psychiatric drugs and vaccines. Now, your recent article on the employment of vaccines in poor developing countries for ulterior motives other than fighting infectious disease, such as a vehicle to implement mass hidden programs to induce infertilization, raises very serious questions on the use of humans as guinea pigs. We already know that our governments, in particular the U.S., the U.K., Canada, and Israel, have very little regard for human life, unless it's totally obedient to their agendas. We witness throughout the Middle East with no remorse over the deaths of thousands of innocent adults and children. We see it in the denial of any wrongdoing in the destruction of Gaza. The multilateral institutions, the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, and the U.S. and British governments can impoverish entire nations by enforcing criminal loans and trade agreements. For the ruling elite, including those who are enforcing mass vaccination right now, human life is expendable unless you're a member of the unique 1%. The most difficult question to ask is whether or not we are witnessing an emergence of a new kind of genocide or eugenics. And we need your insight on this. It is perhaps the most uncomfortable question anyone can ask in order to make any kind of rational sense of the extent of corporate and first world government denial and neglect that is being witnessed today. Several years ago, I published an article investigating whether or not there is a depopulation program that might be underlying the Bill and Melissa Gates Foundation's commitment to vaccines in developing nations. It is public knowledge, not hearsay, not speculation, that Bill Gates advocates massive global population reduction. Now we have reported on a recent case in Kenya of tetanus vaccine laced with anti-human hormone to induce infertility and miscarriages. And again, it's against the poor black population. We saw this before occurring in other countries in the early 1990s, in the Philippines and then in Mexico. They were caught. It was acknowledged, but no one was held accountable. It also happened in the Amazon and in Thailand. Now, although the World Health Organization and the UNDP and the UN's Population Fund and the World Bank were caught in the scheme, along with U.S. federal health agencies who were involved in at least in the Philippines, it appears the World Health Organization, along with the UNICEF, is set on depopulation via the vaccines. That is the contention. So explain whether or not this contention is real or not. The forum is yours.
Yes, as you said, it's a very hard question to answer, but I honestly believe with all my heart that it is true, that this is happening. I'm even more convinced since I was lucky enough to speak to Dr. Wahome Nagari, who was one of the doctors that actually was an expert that tested the vaccines, finding the HCG hormone in them, the tetanus vaccines in Kenya. And he gave me some papers dating back as far back as the 1970s and slightly before that as well, stating clearly that they were looking to depopulize. And it is very clear from those papers, which I gave a link to on my last article that I've just written, along with the radio show that I did with Dr. Nagari and Roger Landley from the the Liberty Beacon Project. We actually got lucky. We spoke to him, and we spoke to him for nearly an hour. Sorry, my son's just walked in. Can I speak to you later, darling? Yeah, so, yes, those papers clearly said that they were, there was, they were talking about depopulation and how they were going to do it. And also, I've seen other papers. I saw papers from the WHO dating back. This was actually the minutes of a meeting dating back as far back as 1992. And that, again, listed vaccine fertility, the fertility regulating vaccines. And it was very clear that these vaccines, they'd already found them to prove that they rendered primates infertile. And they were looking to test them on the women. And the actual meeting was with several groups of women, sort of human rights women and women that were looking into sort of contraception and that kind of thing for the developing countries. And there were several different groups, which I actually sort of put out in my article. And also the WHO were with, as you say, the UNP and the World Bank. And it was a very, very clear from right through that paper what they were trying to do. They were saying that the vaccines weren't out there. The vaccines were being tested at the moment. They were being looked at, and they were trying to find out if they would be able to sort of, help with the sort of rise of population. And when you read it to begin with, I mean, it was very, very deceiving because it looked like it was just a contraceptive vaccine. However, when they started explaining it in detail, it took a sinister turn, and it really was describing the vaccine that later came out, which was the tetanus vaccine, which they, as you said, they tried out in the early 90s. This was tried out again in 2013, and this was tried out in Kenya, and it was using the same vaccine, the tetanus vaccine, laced with the HCG hormone, which is a hormone that's naturally found in pregnant women. However, when it's mixed with the tetanus toxoid, then it becomes lethal and it renders women infertile. And Dr. Nagari explained this very, very great detail on the radio to me. And he said that, in fact, to prevent these vaccines from being tested, they actually put vaccines under lock and key and under police guard, so that nobody could test the vaccines. Each time they were asked if they could test the vaccines, they were refused. They weren't allowed to test the vaccines. Eventually, they did manage to get a couple of the vials of vaccines. They did test them, and lo and behold, they had the HCG hormone in them.
From what I understand,
Dr. Nagari actually told me that on the radio that at least 100 million women have already been made infertile right across the developing countries, 100 million women. And I asked him point blank, I said, do you think this is eugenics? And he said, yes, in my opinion, I do. So it was a very, very strong, very powerful interview. And, you know, it did really open my eyes to exactly what was going on.
Okay,
and
now,
it's very frightening, very, very scary indeed.
Well,
it's clear that they're trying to depopulize. And that's what they're trying to do. And
Christina, I have another issue I'd like for you to address.
Yeah, sure.
Also, I believe it was 6 or 7 separate vials were sent, and all the different vials were shown to have been contaminated with the HCG, the gonadotropin hormone that induces, as you said, the infertility and causes miscarriages. And that was launched on the population, and they tried to cover it up. The fact that you have the documents, the fact that you had their minutes, the fact that you have physicians, including a group of Catholic physicians who helped discover this and have all this evidence. So this is not a conspiracy theorist. This is something very serious. When you implement a program of eugenics, selective destruction of life that you do not consider valuable, to 100 million women, and they all just happen to be black, and they just all happen to be poor. What do you think would happen if they decided to for example, chemically castrate men who are wealthy and successful? How well do you think that would be accepted? How long before that became an outrage and was covered on the headlines newspapers? That is the double standard by which we are measuring this. Now, my question is this. You're familiar with Bill Gates and his foundation, and you know that they've been associated with huge catastrophic vaccine debacles in recent years. Several years ago, his funding of a more potent polio vaccine resulted in injuries and 47,000 deaths in India in a single year, whereas the year before only, I believe they had a couple polio deaths. And the World Health Organization and Gates also are being tried by the Indian government as we speak for secretive experimentation on 16,000 girls with Gardasil, which is a completely fraudulent, deadly vaccine that no one should ever take. Yeah. And this is in tribal areas, resulting in many deaths. Now, in your investigations, what have you been uncovering about the scope and mission of Bill Gates' vaccine agenda?
Well, many people know by now that I was the one that broke the Chad story. And Chad's story was really what brought it all to my attention in a big way. I mean, I'd always had my suspicions. However, I was contacted by a gentleman from, he was actually from Chad, and he was actually contacting me from N'Djamena, which is the capital of Chad. But this is North Africa, for anybody that doesn't know. And he said to me that he knew about an experiment that was going on in a school that went on in a school in a little village, a little tiny village, and it involved 500 children who were locked into a school and were told that if they didn't have this vaccine, which their parents didn't know anything about, if they didn't have this vaccine, then they were to have no more education at that school. And as you can imagine, children, especially children in Africa, are desperate to have education. They want to learn. They want to know. And they're lovely, lovely, lovely children who, you know, through my investigations, I got to sort of know. And it was very, very sad indeed. And these 500 children, they were vaccinated. And within hours, 106 became very seriously ill. They could see there was a problem. They went back to the village, and 106 became very ill. 40 of those, well, I was originally given the figure 40. It actually rose to 50. But 40 of those, the figure I was given by this gentleman, and I had all the documents to prove it. He sent me newspapers from the actual village itself, which was a small, very, very small newspaper called Le Vox. And he did prove that this was all happening. So I went back to Jeff from Back Truth, and I spoke to him, and I said, can we run this? He said, well, as you have got the papers, paperwork, yes. Because 40 of these children were taken to hospital, and these children were having very, very severe, they had paralysis and very, very severe convulsions. And these convulsions, they needed five people to hold down a child, children as young as eight. Most of the children that were injured were 8 to, I think, 17 or 19. And they were very, you could see that they were very, very disabled and very, very ill. We had film footage from a Chad TV station, which we did show on Back Truth, which was all in French, but we did translate it for people. So that I got translators to translate all the papers for me. I had government documents. I had children's medical records that were leaked to me. So I did know it was a fact. I did know it was true. And that on the medical records, it was stating it was a vaccine injury caused by Menafrac. Menafrac is a meningitis A vaccine that was able to, it was supposed to be able to go across the cold chain and be able to be kept in quite high temperatures, as compared to the other vaccines that you can't keep. You have to keep them refrigerated. And the more we learn and the more that we went on, I did a series of five articles on this. And I know that the last article I wrote on it, I was explaining what had happened to these children. The children were eventually, seven of them, the worst cases, were taken off to Tunisia by the World Health Organization. Now, the people that are involved with the World Health Organization, UNICEF, the Gates Foundation, PATH, Gavi, all the big organizations, everything was all involved in this one program. And seven children were flown secretly from Nijima Airport. The airport was closed to the public that day. It was all run by the WHO, which they call SMEDI, which is still a WHO. It's the World Health Organization. And all this happened. They closed the airport. They sent them off in a private jet. No one knew where they were going. No, not even the parents. Seven parents were allowed to go with them, and nurses and that. No one knew where they were going. They had no visas. They weren't told where they were going until they were on the plane. I was leaked information from a nurse. Now, the nurse actually that was involved with all this, I'm not actually sure if it was a he or she, because it was leaked through somebody else, but it was via a nurse. And they told me what had been going on. I gave an article. I put an article out explaining what had been going on and what they were doing. It was very definite that the children were vaccine damaged, but to hide this, they called it mass hysteria. And that's what came out in the media, and that there was nothing to worry about. There was no injuries to these children whatsoever. Now, today, these children, this was only just over a year ago, I think it was probably about 2 years ago now. Today, those children are still very, very ill, at least 40 children within that village. They're having huge rages, huge convulsions. They've got no medical supplies, no advice, no medical help, nothing at all. And the vaccine program has been hailed a success by the Gates Foundation.
Final question.
Yes.
Although research is increasingly coming to light that implicates the viral components in vaccines as being unsafe and even ineffective in many cases, as with the influenza, mumps, pertussis, and measles, it has also been the additional ingredients where we find the greatest scientific denialism occurring within the pro-vaccine establishment and government health agencies. Now the new generation Gardasil vaccine will have increased amounts of aluminum. And all of these ingredients have an adverse impact upon the immune system and neurological development. If this is intentional, what might be the long-term motive and mission behind injecting children with this roof toxic chemicals? Or maybe it's not intentional. It's just that they believe that these are not going to have the adverse effect that we've seen them having. Your thoughts, please.
Well, they are having very adverse reactions to these vaccines, and this has been going on for quite a while now. I mean, there was written the vigilant experiments that you actually was talking about in India, where the actual, I think three women took the has taken it to the Supreme Courts of India, which have heard about it all. The vaccines were actually tried out originally on tribal women, and five died, and there was a lot of injuries, lots and lots of adverse reactions. Now, they've known all the way along that these vaccines cause adverse reactions, and the adverse reactions are becoming more and more. I mean, we've got sites like A Truth About Gardasil. We've got Leslie Carol Botha speaking out about it. We have SaneVax, all of which are talking and speaking about it. We have wonderful, wonderful scientists like Dr. Lucia Tomogenovic and Professor Christopher Shaw, all describing the injuries, all stating that these vaccines are very dangerous. Have we seen anybody pull back from the vaccine programs? No. All we've seen is them pushing them more and more and more, and pushing them onto younger children and more vulnerable children. They've even looked at actually vaccinating very young babies with these cervical cancer vaccines. And they're even vaccinating boys with them now, saying that it protects them from anal cancer and various other cancers. So to say that it's...
Well, we're,
they
unfortunately,
don't know what
we're out of
doing.
Time. Christina,
I think they probably do, and they just don't care.
Christina, you do care, and your website is Parents and Carriers Against Medical Injustice. We appreciate it. Christina England, E-N-G-L-E-N, England. And a website is vactruth.com. Thank you very much for being with us today from the United Kingdom, Christina.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
And we're out of time. Just think of that. None of the information we just shared is on any of the discussion platforms or talking points in the United States when it comes to vaccines. 100 million women made sterile. Poor African women by the Gates Foundation and by the World Health Organization. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.